Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, live from the Bay, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. Look, we just had the second straight blowout victory by the Golden State Warriors. Don't come on here with your wet blanket stuff, okay? We got to give the people a reason to listen. We can't have 40 minutes of you moaning and groaning about Kevin Durant and competitive balance, okay? We need to have some like high energy talk about a finals that frankly could be halfway over.
Fair enough. And I'm really gonna work hard not to be the wet blanket here. It's Sunday night, we're both a little punchy, and the Warriors dominated all over again. You were there, so why don't we kick things off with your impressions from the stadium?
So it was an interesting evening kind of all around. There were the elements of a disaster for Golden State, and I'm staring straight at Steph Curry with that. I mean, the 8 turnovers, one more head slapping after the next. This is how they lose, right? They shoot themselves in the foot. They either lose their composure or they just, you know, throw away possessions. And there was so much talk after game one about that possession game. And here comes Steph Curry sort of reverting to his old really bad habits, like at the worst possible moment. But then about halfway through the game, it became clear that, guess what? This isn't the old Warriors. Like, they have that same margin of error that we saw in game one, named Kevin Durant, where he can paper over a lot of shortcomings, a lot of mistakes, any roster weaknesses that you might have with an all-around sensational game. And the confidence level, especially in the second half from the home crowd, was very high. Golden State's ability to kick it into high gear and kind of answer every big shot from Cleveland or every drive from LeBron James with a big highlight play of their own really has, you know, Golden State Warriors fans back where they were finally after game two of last year's finals, which is, you know, feeling confident and pretty comfortable, I think.
Yeah, full-on arrogance season, as they call it on the internet. Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, if you were a Warriors fan sitting there in that game, that second quarter must have given a lot of people flashbacks to last year's finals. Like, there was a stretch there where Steph was making just like a handful of inexplicable mistakes.
I mean, just terrible passes. Then he drops the ball. And meanwhile, LeBron's going at the rim at will.
That was the
play
thing.
After
that
play.
Was the thing. LeBron was just in Terminator mode and getting whatever he wanted. And then Kyrie was sort of struggling through that first half. And I was watching it thinking, all right, so if Kyrie goes off in the second half, they could really do some damage here. And then you see, like, there were a handful of moments, even in that first half, where every time the Cavs got close, KD came in and hit a big shot or came up with a stop on defense. Like, it just, there were a couple key moments where Durant was just unstoppable. And then it all broke wide open in the toward the end of that third quarter and into the fourth quarter, where it was like, all right, this is really not a fair fight at this point. And I don't know, man. My take on that game is that, number one, the Cavs played really well. Like, Kevin Love surpassed my expectations for him in this series. I mean, there were a couple other Cavs, like Tristan Thompson only had 4 points and 4 rebounds. J.R. Smith is in the middle of like a late career crisis here. And Kyrie was pretty uneven also. But LeBron was great, Love was great, and the Cavs sort of muddied up the game and had it looking like a close game for a significant stretch tonight, and it wasn't even close to enough. And so it's got to be pretty demoralizing for them. But then the flip side is, I'm sitting here, and now I like 16-0 is more realistic than it's ever been.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even go so far quite to say as muddied up the game. I mean, Golden State comes out with 40 in the first quarter, and they had a ton of self-inflicted mistakes. I mean, they had 67 at halftime. Again,
yeah,
to me, that could have been 75-80, you know, and it's just crazy to even say these things. On the night, Golden State scored 132. That's the most points in a finals game in 3 decades, right? And that's comical because, again, like we're saying, you know, Steph Curry for a while there looked like he had all of his basketball abilities just draining out of his body. But your point on LeBron in terms of, you know, where he was at, it seemed like he was heading towards control of this game, right? He wasn't necessarily getting to the free throw line that much, and I think he's probably a little bit frustrated about that. I mean, you look at his 5 free throws, you know, what did Steph finish with? 14 free throw attempts. I mean, I'm sure that's gonna kind of stick in LeBron's craw. but he's getting to the rim. He's blowing by whoever is guarding him on the perimeter, and the help defense isn't really doing too much to affect what he's doing. Simultaneously, you know, he's finding their shooters. He's creating offense off the cuts. They're kind of getting what their goal was, which is if we downsize this game, spread things out, that will be their best method for kind of cracking Golden State's defense. The problem is, Cleveland can't get stops when they go small, you know, and they want to play this up and down style. And they're basically just hoping that chaos mode will somehow, you know, screw the Warriors over. Like Steph will have all these mistakes. They'll just get too loosey goosey, take bad shots. And, you know, somehow Golden State's offense will sort of, you know, come back to earth just by, you know, kind of sheer variance.
Right.
That's not happening. You know, like this up and down stuff is getting Golden State tons of open shots at the basket. Durant, Curry, both were there constantly. And then the three-pointers were really falling for Golden State tonight.
And the other thing that we should point out is that not all small ball is created equal, okay? Because it's like the Wizards have a small ball lineup where they shift Markieff Morris to center, and they have, like, they throw out Oubre, put Otto Porter at power forward. And it's fun for what it is, but, like, I wouldn't roll it out in the NBA Finals and expect it to work. And the same is true with the Cavs, who were really, like, they were counting on Richard Jefferson for significant stretches tonight. Iman Shumpert, who, you know, is not terrible, but is also not nearly as good as his reputation has suggested over the last, like, 6 years. And Channing Frye, who, I mean, he looks old. Channing Frye is great with podcasts, but has looked pretty old throughout the playoffs and again tonight, where, like, they sort of dusted him off as a last resort. And you know, there's a ceiling on what that team can do if that's their small ball option.
Yeah, it is a bad sign if your bench has two podcasters or more. I think that's sort of the the yeah, cutoff.
Exactly.
Like, when your rotation's relying on Channing Frye and Richard Jefferson to give you big minutes, and I guess that's not really true of Frye. I mean, he didn't play in game one, and they tried to sneak him in game two, and I thought, you know, he was a mismatch problem, you know, especially defensively. Immediately Golden State goes small to try to mess with him, and then he just couldn't finish anything around the basket and really played smaller than he is, so he didn't give them, you know, much of anything during his playing time. But yeah, that's a bad sign. Hey, one thought I had the last couple of days, you know, we had that big role player debate where I was giving you a hard time about calling KD a role player, and you actually had a lot of Andrew Sharp stans come out of the woodwork in the emails to be like, look, you know, either kind of defending your point in terms of how he's fitting in on offense to a system that was already there, or at least just defending your honor in general.
You know how I know the podcast is working? Like, when we get feedback that is 50% like, that's exactly how I feel, and then 50% that's the dumbest shit I've ever heard in my life. And that's about where we are on all of the Durant talk. So I'm enjoying it.
So here's my counter to all of this, because I spent a fair bit of time this weekend reading these emails of people saying, look, Sharp's not that crazy for calling KD a role player. What I really failed to point out last time is that this guy's defensive impact is out of this world. I mean, he's an all-defense level player at this point of his career, and what you're seeing in this finals is exactly what you just underscored a minute ago. Not all small ball lineups are created equal. Kevin Durant's out there looking like the best center in the league. You know, it's like, I mean, it's weird to think of that, but when the game gets that small, he's the best rim protector on the court. He's having a huge presence on the glass, and when everybody else is shorter and not as long as he is, you start to really see, you know, his physical abilities come through on that end. His stat line tonight, 33 points, 13 rebounds, 6 assists. I'm not even done. I'm halfway done. 3 steals, 5 blocks, right? That
yes.
is the kind of line I was looking for, the best comps for that line. And it's a crazy one to come up with. Tim Duncan 2003 finals is sort of like the best comp for that stat line when you're looking all across the board in all 5 of those categories, when you're looking at finals performances. I mean, would you ever expect that we'd be comparing Kevin Durant to Tim Duncan? You know, but this is how the game has changed. And this is why he's not just a guy who's fitting in offensively. I mean, this is a guy who's having a major impact both sides of the ball.
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to double down on my role player comments, but I will say that, like, what I meant is that he doesn't have that superstar's burden that someone like LeBron has. I will say this, though, that basically what we're seeing is when KD is a role player for your team is unstoppable. When he can basically pick a couple spots in each game where he goes off and just takes over the game, like it happened midway through the fourth, he hit a couple shots and it was like, all right, well, this game is over. And then, you know, there's just nothing a team can do. And you're right. You're dead right to point out his defensive impact, because just like his length alone has screwed with some of LeBron's cross-court passes, and he's protecting the rim. I mean, he had one block on Kevin Love that was just like sort of even more demoralizing than this series has already been. And Draymond got Love in game one. And I feel bad for Kevin Love in all of these Warriors games, because he's actually playing pretty well and it still doesn't matter. And yeah, your point about Durant is dead on. And I have to be honest, like, he is dominating this series to an extent that I didn't really expect. And there have been a lot of Warriors games throughout the year where he hasn't really sort of taken over in the way that he has in these Cavs games. And
he has something to prove, though, right now. I mean, he's in that mode. Like, you can see it. There's a ferocity to the way that he's playing. And you could say the same thing actually about Steph, too. You know, Draymond, after the game, said that he thought both those guys, Steph and KD, were playing the most locked-in basketball that he's ever seen them play in their careers. I would have to agree. I mean, absent Steph's turnover issues tonight, I mean, the way he was pulling himself back together, getting some of those offensive rebounds that were pretty critical in the third quarter, continuing to work the offense, racking up assists late in that game to kind of ice it away. I really like Steph's response there. But in terms of KD, like, my fear with KD in this series was shrinkage, right? Like, falling away from the moment. That is not what happened. That's not what's happening at all. And in fact, quite the opposite. I mean, after the game, LeBron James is asked, you know, tell us more about kind of KD's impact. And remember, after game one, he said, look, KD's the difference here. And after game two, he comes back and he says, look, they're a different team. You guys asked me before, what was the difference? I already told you, they're a different team.
Yeah. Well, and it should be obvious to everyone. You know, this is not rocket science. This was a 73-win team that then added the only other, like, superstar that was in that top three mix. Like, of course they're a different team. And it's wild to watch, you know? I mean, you're completely right that KD is owning the series. And I think it may change the way this title is perceived for him. I mean, you said, this was not my take, this was your take. Like, 6 weeks ago, you were wondering whether people were going to really look at this as a real breakthrough moment for Durant. And now the way he's taken over and the way he's dominated, I think you have to give him some credit, regardless of how you feel about the way that the competitive balance has shaken out.
Look, I might even go one step further. If the Warriors sweep the Cavaliers, KD's averaging like 35-10-8, and he's the most impactful defensive player on the court, we're going to be spending the summer debating KD versus LeBron, who's the best player.
Yeah. All right. Well, actually, we have two. We're not going to answer any mailbag questions on this podcast. We're going to keep it tight, 35 to 40 minutes. But two tweets that I want to address. And it's both from this guy named Tori Juarez. He says, first, here's my KD role player hot take. I don't care about LeBron's numbers. He is the third best player in this series. Do you agree?
Who is LeBron?
Yeah.
Well, through two games, if we're talking about impact, I'd say he's the third most impactful.
No, that's a unnecessarily diplomatic answer. Is he the third best player
no,
in this series?
I would say he's no worse than second, but I think KD's been the best player so far during the series.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, so are you trying to argue for Steph over LeBron as well?
I think, yeah, through two games, the best players on the court have been Steph and KD, and I think that's the difference in not only the series. Obviously, it's a difference in the series, but I also think it's the difference in the Warriors. Like, this is the KD Steph union is working better this week than it worked for like 95% of the regular season, and it's all clicking right now. And I mean, we're sort of seeing how helpless the rest of the league is. The Cavs are head and shoulders above everybody else and can't do shit with the Warriors right now.
Yeah, I'd go farther than that. It's working better than 100% of the regular season. It's working better than at any other point of the postseason. I mean, these guys are turning it on when it matters. We talked about that kind of coming into the postseason, that we felt like the Warriors definitely had another gear, and I think that they're getting there. They said after game one, you know, we can be better, and you kind of laughed at them for that. Well, I think we saw them better in game two because all four of their stars had it going. I mean, Klay was able to kind of hit some shots finally, even though he was still like in this crazy forcing it environment. Draymond was able to hit some threes. You know, there was a couple that he missed and, you know, kind of missed badly, and a few that you kind of closed your eyes on which he hadn't taken, but he was contributing as well offensively. And then Steph and KD are both going nuts. And I mean, it goes back for Cleveland with a lot of empty minutes. I mean, not just their bench guys. J.R. Smith, you know, what's up? Like, where did he make the trip?
And you know what? J.R., I don't know, what's his contract? Because basically, LeBron put the pressure on the Cavs to sign J.R. to a pretty significant deal. And that deal is not aging well.
Yeah, I mean, and it will be funny who takes the blame for some of these backfire moves by Cleveland, because they didn't really have a choice on some of these. Like, they really needed to keep JR. I mean, he is under contract. I'm looking at their books right now. Good news. He's under contract.
Oh, man.
He's under contract through 2020. So, I don't know. I mean, do we give him a little bit of a pass because of the family stuff off the court, his injury earlier this season? I mean, that could be playing into it, but they needed him to be at least good, you know, maybe not great or like all NBA level, but he had to be at least good in this series.
Not useless. Useless was not acceptable. And that's where we are right now. And that's where Tristan Thompson is, man. I mean, what's up with Tristan Thompson? Is there any explanation beyond the Kardashian curse?
Well, I think they were saying kind of coming into game two, basically, that they felt Golden State was making it like a point of emphasis to kind of keep him off the glass, and that's where he gets so much of his stuff. He was able to score a little bit more in game two off just kind of junk stuff around the basket, but he still wasn't having that big time impact on the rebounding and the second chance points. And I think what we're going to see going forward here is his minutes are going to continue to get cut. They're going to play, you know, Shumpert and Jefferson more, so they have more guys who can, like, you know, credibly attempt to guard Kevin Durant, you know, to just go smaller and hope that they can do a better job there, and then also just get more shooters on the court. I think one of the big problems with Tristan is his presence allows, whether it's Zaza or Draymond, to just kind of camp out in the key, right? So that's just one more body LeBron and Kyrie are driving into, one more set of arms those guys have to shoot their runners and floaters over the top of. And if he's not consistently getting those dump-off passes for dunks like he has in the past, and so far during the series he just hasn't, he's a big time, you know, net negative on their overall offensive efficiency. So I think he's probably going to be phased out here. But the problem is now your lineups are just like mediocre wings surrounding LeBron, you know, and that doesn't do you that much more good, you know.
Let me ask you, do you buy into the Kardashian stuff at all?
I mean, that's a sharp take, man. I don't know.
It's not really a sharp. I never all the like athlete girlfriend ruins athlete stories are always super annoying, but the Kardashian thing is really weird, and I first noticed it because I'm a Carolina fan, and Khloe's first NBA boyfriend was Rashad McCants, and Rashad McCants just went off the reservation after his tryst with Khloe, and then the Harden stuff. I mean, it's hard to argue with the Harden stuff. And now Tristan, I don't know, man. There's something up there.
Yeah, I'm gonna leave that for you.
I don't know. I'm not committing to that opinion either. Okay, so it's just strange. Tristan Thompson has traditionally been the second most valuable, well, third most valuable Cav in these Warriors matchups, and now I don't know what the hell's going on. I think that's the factor that has really shocked me through the first two games.
Yeah, like I'm trying to find some statistical justification, you know, here for your statements, and I do know that in the two games Tristan's played since Khloe Kardashian tweeted out a story that was all about how he was this big time difference maker, he's averaging 4 points and four rebounds in the last two games. So that's well below his season averages, well below his postseason averages. So, you know, maybe the curse is coming through social media as well.
And hey, we wish them the best. It's fine. We're not rooting for any breakup here. But we should move on to the second part of Tori Juarez's question. He says, real question, Seattle gets a team tomorrow and you get to pick anyone. All things considered, do you take Kevin Durant or Steph Curry to start the team?
My answer has been Kevin Durant for years. And I think when you're looking at all around impact, offense, defense, it's KD. I think Steph is probably slightly better offensively in terms of being able to deliver you a more efficient offense as the number one guy with mm-hmm. A lesser cast of characters. But if I had to choose one, I'd choose KD.
Yeah. I mean, it's becoming more entertaining to argue the merits of those two than to actually argue this series, which I think is the overriding point here. But I don't know. I still can't decide because Steph has been more successful, beat KD head-to-head last year. And, I mean, you can credit the Warriors. The Warrior system does deserve credit for some of that. But I think he puts so much pressure on every team trying to guard the Warriors. There's just like a sort of baseline level of panic that comes from trying to deal with Steph that is hard to account for in the numbers. And that's my thing in that argument. I think everybody sort of looks at KD. He's clearly the more complete player. He's clearly the more traditionally dominant player. But I think that Steph affects the game in ways that sometimes are harder to appreciate.
Look, Steph's a good defender. What we're seeing in the finals, Kevin's an elite defender. You know, he is playing minutes, a lot of minutes at center or, you know, modified power forward, whatever you want to call him. And it was like all those jokes we had about LeBron playing puberty ball, you know, where like he's the biggest guy on the court and he's just like ramming it down people's throat on offense and then being the backline defender on defense, sort of like, you know, middle school. That stuff really now applies to KD almost more than LeBron so far during this series. I mean, he has been all over the court. Very similar, actually, to last year's Western Conference Finals, where he was, like, guarding Steph on the perimeter at times on switches and then recovering all the way to the basket and kind of helping Ibaka with the rim protection. You know, he's doing that stuff defensively as well. I think the gap between where Kevin Durant is defensively compared to where Steph is much wider than the flip, you know, the reverse on offense. I mean, I think if Steph's a 10 on offense, KD's like no worse than a 9. KD's at a 10 defensively. You know, Steph, we can give him a 7 or an 8 defensively.
Yeah, well, and Durant, you have to concede, is in a spot where he's able to work really hard on defense, and then like the offense is easier for him because the rest of that team is so good. I mean, it's... I don't think that
he would
be
playing. Well,
the offense
is so easy for him because he's one of the greatest, most gifted scorers in NBA history. Okay, he's taking it to LeBron.
Take it down a notch.
He's bringing it up the court by himself, defensive rebound, shoulder shimmying, staring down Rihanna. I mean, he's playing out of his minds right now.
I watched Thunder Warriors last year, which is the first time that KD really hit that next level defensively and shut down Draymond and nearly ruined the Warriors season. And he was great, but he also expending that much energy hurt his offense down the stretch in that series, I'm convinced. And so that, like, I think that he's able to shine in both roles this time around because his job is so much easier playing on that team.
Yes. But if you take Steph and you take away his defensive protection, you know.
Yeah, you could make the same arguments with Steph. Yeah, that's correct. I don't know. It's really, really close. I think that they are, I mean, I was arguing with people who I was watching the game with tonight. Like, they're tied for second as far as I'm concerned in terms of overall talents in the league. LeBron is still head and shoulders above everyone else, I believe. But
really?
They
really? Even after watching this game tonight, really?
LeBron was awesome tonight, man. I mean, they didn't lose because of LeBron.
No, I agree with you. I'm just saying KD was really good. I mean, is really huge all-around impact. I'm not making the case I'm going to say Kevin Durant's a better player than LeBron going into next season. I think LeBron will most likely still have that number one spot in our top 100 rankings, but it's never been closer between those two than right now, today.
Yeah. What do you think? Jeff Van Gundy called Steph and KD the best duo ever. Do you agree with that statement?
Oh, that's a big one.
it's early to make that claim. Yeah. I think we're going to need a couple more years.
Yeah, Van Gundy is trying to make the headlines to keep this thing interesting, because I heard he thought the Warriors are going to make 10 straight finals. And that's a big number. That's a big number, too.
It's tough. Congrats to Van Gundy for having the hottest takes this June.
Look, I respect the hustle, because I'm hyping up Kevin Durant a lot, and so is Van Gundy. We still need to see him do this, right? And you know, that was one of Steph's messages coming out of the game, too, was there's a lot of work to do. I love that focus. You know, somebody asked Draymond, you know, how have you kept, you know, your composure? How have you been so restrained? And Draymond kind of snapped at him a little bit, but then he kind of admitted what we've all been saying, which is he quote unquote learned his lesson. You know, he got burned last year during the finals, and he's not going to let himself get burned again. That sentiment is something that I really saw crystallize in the Western Conference Finals when they were tested a little bit by the Spurs, and they just, you know, brought the consistent defensive energy every single game. And I think you're really seeing that reinforced in these games as well. When they're going up 20 points, was there any time during game one or game two where you thought they were going to blow that 20-point lead?
No. And even when it's a close game. So I promised I was not going to be like the wet blanket, but my criticism of tonight's game is that it was actually pretty fun and it felt close for, you know, the first three quarters. It was they were sort of trading blows. There was a ridiculous amount of talent out there, and it was fun to watch. But my thing is as a fan who's watched the Warriors all year, like at no point did I have any doubt that the Warriors were going to pull away in the second half. And that's exactly what happened. And it just, at some point, I feel like this is going to get kind of repetitive. Maybe we're already there. Maybe some people are there and some people aren't. But it's just, when LeBron was going nuts, it felt like a moment. And then, like, 2 minutes later, it just didn't really matter. And that's kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah, there was times during that game where I thought that could be a Cavs win. I mean, granted, it was very early. They had a lot more work to do than they did. But, you know, when Steph's throwing the ball over the court, LeBron's playing well, like, that is how this unfolds in Cleveland's favor, right? And both those things finally happened sort of simultaneously in a Warriors game. And so there was more intrigue, I thought, in game two, much more than game one. The result wound up being the same. And you're mentioning the fatigue factor, or, you know, does this get repetitive? And, you know, after game two, LeBron doesn't go to the podium. You know, he didn't go to the podium on the practice day on Sunday. He didn't participate in the conference call on Friday. Sorry, he didn't go to practice podium on Saturday. He just did like a media scrum, and he's surrounded by just a comical number of media members. I mean, it was like 150 people surrounding him on all sides, you know, probably 20 cameras pointed at him. I mean, it was completely overwhelming the facilities.
Imagine being the PR guy that hears that and just has to like sit there and be like, all right, so I guess we're going to have 200 people crowd into this locker room and try to make that work. Like, yeah, it's tough. People don't realize how small those locker rooms are.
No, they were like begging LeBron too. Like, there's a report out there that like NBA PR officials were strongly requesting LeBron, like, come to the podium. And
strictly from a logistics standpoint. And I kind of like LeBron taking a stand there, because apparently Windhorst said he didn't like the way the press conferences were being run. It sort of, it spoke to the midlife crisis vibe that this series is taking on. Like, LeBron just wants to control the things that he can control here.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a little bit of a cover story, but I also...
Well, tell us your theories.
No, I don't want to get into like alternate theories. I just think he's frustrated, you know? Like, okay. I think he's looking at this Warriors team and he's thinking, wow, like, Kevin Durant finally has figured out how to beat me, and I'm the only person on our team who can guard him. I can't guard him for the entire game. And by the way, we don't have anybody who can guard Steph Curry either. And we've got a coach in Ty Lue who's saying, run, run, run. Let's pick up the tempo and the pace against a team that just loves playing at the fastest possible speed and can dice you apart in transition. And I think, you know, to a certain degree, that's frustrating. I mean, he was very short with reporters tonight, LeBron was. There was one exchange where a reporter asked him, hey, you know, do you just have to protect home court now? And LeBron's like, well, are you a smart guy? You know, I mean, it's just, there's no patience. I think the patience basically is gone for him. And I really thought he came out with a extra half step to his game tonight, like extra motor. I mean, he really seemed locked in and focused from the opening tip, and it wasn't close to enough. And I think LeBron, when I've watched him in past series where he's felt overwhelmed, it's not like he checks out. Like, that's way too strong of a phrase. Yeah. But he knows first, right? Like, he's the one who understands. Like,
that's a good way to explain it.
The balance of the series. And I think he understands that, you know, the Warriors are not as kind of foolhardy or overconfident as they were last year. And I think he understands, like, Steph is a much better player in this series than he was in last year's series, too.
Yeah, that's the craziest part of this whole thing, though, is that we've seen enough evidence to realize that LeBron is at the top of his game, at the peak of his powers, however you want to describe it. Like, he is late 90s Jordan right now, and can do whatever he wants, and has just finished imposing his will on the entire East and making it look more hopeless than ever for those guys. And now seeing him rendered irrelevant is quite something, you know? I mean, I think it's a powerful commentary on how dominant the Warriors are, you know? That is the takeaway, is that watching LeBron just, because you're right, he hasn't packed it in whatsoever until, like, the fourth quarters of both these games, he's been kind of checked out. But, like, he was going full tilt all night tonight, and it just wasn't enough. And it wasn't enough to even really create that much drama.
Yeah, I mean, the game was over halfway through the third, and that's tough. And that's not a spot LeBron's used to being in either, right? Like, how often does he really get blown off the court? And when you look at some of, like, his worst plus-minus games of his career, it's been against the Warriors in recent years. Like, this is, like, uncharted waters, unprecedented territory. Yes, he was swept when he was very, very young in his first finals. But even, like, the 2014 finals against the Spurs wasn't this bad, you know? Like,
yeah.
There was still tension early in that series, especially in game one.
Oh, no. Those first two games, people forget how close those first two games were. And I think he won game two, right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it went back to Miami, and I think everyone expected it to be sort of another 6 or 7 game series, and then the bottom fell out with Wade and Bosch. And LeBron was kind of marginalized. He got his numbers, but he tailed off too.
Hey, one thing that we haven't mentioned at all is the Steve Kerr factor. Don't you think Steve Kerr is breathing a sigh of relief tonight?
Yeah, I mean, certainly when I found out that he was coming back, I was like, man, I hope they don't lose. This could be pretty uncomfortable.
Like, Mike Brown's undefeated without Steve Kerr. Luke Walton has, like, the greatest start to an NBA season ever without Steve Kerr. He comes back for finals game two and they lose. It'd be, like, the worst thing ever.
You know what else? Draymond hit his first three, which certainly eased some of my fears, because Draymond has been playing so well under Mike Brown, and he and Steve Kerr have apparently had issues and, like, just a weird relationship.
I'm not a robot.
Surrounding threes. Yeah. So Draymond is still doing his thing, which is how you know that the Warriors are probably going to be okay with Kerr.
Well, yeah, we should give Kerr some credit for pulling Klay Thompson out of his slump too, right? Because before the game, Kerr's like, oh yeah, he's like a, you know, he's hitting line drives all over the field. You know, eventually he's going to break through and, you know, those will be hits. And that's kind of what happened with Klay tonight. I mean, wasn't a perfect game by any stretch. You know, he had a couple forced shots, but, you know, he finally got his outside shooting going, and that was backbreaking to the Cavs too, I think. You know, we had mentioned Klay Thompson as sort of an X factor coming into this series.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of, if he plays well, they're going to win the series. If he plays poorly, that opens the door for Cleveland. Now, Kyrie had a comment about, like, well, now Klay's hitting shots too, you know, and they're in this position where, you know, they can't, the roof is leaking in, like, 15 different spots. They don't have enough buckets for all the leaks, right?
Yeah. All right. So I want to finish up with two questions. This has been kind of a dark podcast, because we're just describing games that don't really have any chance of being dramatic, and it's so clear that the Warriors are going to win. However, two questions here. Do you think they're going 16-0? Is that an outcome that you're hoping for?
Well, I consulted with Kevin Pelton. He says the computers still give Cleveland about a 50-50 shot to win a game.
Uh-huh.
So for whatever that's worth, I mean, to me, it's game three or bust. I think if they lose game three, it's going to be Cancun. You know, it's going to be one of those games where it's like 150-80. And
look, J.R. Smith and Tristan Thompson are already there.
Yeah, probably. Maybe Chloe's a travel agent. But I think that game four really could get completely away from everybody. Like, if you think about, not only are they going for the undefeated thing, but they could run up their point differential. Like, their all-time point differential could be, like, many points higher than every previous champion.
Hold on. Are you implying that the Warriors are going to take the floor for Game 4 of the NBA Finals, thinking about their point differential?
These guys do. They're light years, man. Like, they know all,
I don't know.
They know all this stuff. Trust me, they do. I've heard them reference it.
Whatever you say.
I'm not saying they're going to be like, well, we have to go from like 16.9 to 17.2, right? I'm just saying they know if they get a 40-point win in Game 4, that's going to be the icing on the cake and solidify them among the greatest, right?
Speaking of icing on the cake, do you remember when LeBron had his Halloween party and yep. made those 3-1 cookies?
So you're saying that Draymond's going to, after Game 4, he's going to go up to the podium and just go cookies, cookies, cookies?
Yeah, no, what I'm saying is that a lot of people may have forgotten that. One person who definitely has not forgotten that is Draymond Green. And he will remind the Warriors before Game 4 if a sweep is on the table, and they will finish this.
Yes. And I think if you're the Cavs, that's a really hard game to get up for. So the whole season, to me, it's Game 3, right? I mean, I think if they win Game 3, then, you know, I could still see Golden State taking Game 4 as well. But
so as a journalist, though, are you rooting for more games? Because if it goes 5, I'm going to try to make a trip to the Bay Area for Game 5. But I think as a basketball fan, I would prefer this to end in 4 because it just would be a cooler story if this Warriors team finishes 16-0. And it would be a more accurate rendering of what they did throughout the playoffs. Like, this team should go 16-0.
Well, you said as a journalist, so we're contractually obligated to root for the quote-unquote best story, right?
Uh-huh.
The best possible story is the Warriors get up 3-0, the Cavs win.
True. That's factually accurate.
Because then we have the biggest choke surpassed by the really biggest choke, and LeBron is, you know, now in every Jordan conversation for all time, right? But I think we can probably agree that's not going to happen. The second best story is what you've pinpointed, which is Warriors sweep, and now we can discuss, are they the greatest team of all time? They're going to have an awesome case for the greatest team of all time if they do this. They could have the best point differential in the playoffs in NBA history. They could have a top 5 point differential in the regular season. They could have one of like the 15 best records in the regular season, and they could have the best postseason record ever. Surely their offensive rating here in the playoffs will most likely wind up among the very best. That's a lot of evidence, not to mention they've got, you know, the stars to kind of back it all up, right? It's not just like some fluky, like crazy 6-week span where role players are like playing out of their minds. It's 4 all-stars and 2 MVPs.
Speaking of best team ever, how many times during these games do you wonder about how many titles the Warriors will win this decade?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a big topic at the Warriors World event, as you can imagine. Arrogant season is in full effect, and they're not like they're saying they've got this one in the bag, but certainly there was a lot of dynasty discussion. I still think that the over-under, including this title, but not including 2015, should be at 2.5, but you could convince me that maybe should be up to 3.5. You know, they've been so dominant this year, they're going to have the Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Draymond core together for the foreseeable future, and they're going to be able to get a constant reload on the supporting cast pieces through, you know, all the mechanisms that those kind of dominant teams always do, you know, just getting the veteran guys on minimum deals and plugging them in. That I see this going on for a while. I think the biggest problems, you know, in terms of how long can it last, you know, obviously contractually, you know, do you want to keep paying for a guy's max money, or do you decide to trade a guy like Klay Thompson away? You know, that could change the balance. You know, that's going to be a couple years down the road. And then also, you know, just Draymond's physical ability. How long is he able to play at an elite level? You know, at some point, if he gets a half step slower,
that's a good point.
He's not going to be quite as good. But with Steph and Kevin Durant, I mean, they're in their primes right now. They should have 3 more solid years of like A+ basketball. All of those could be titles.
Yeah. Well, they're in a, I mean, Van Gundy hyperbole aside, they are in the conversation with Shaq and Kobe and Wade and LeBron a couple years ago, Scotty and Michael. I mean, there haven't been, whether they're the best duo or not, there have not been very many who can sort of match the level that they're on right now. And couple that with a supporting cast that could not possibly be better. Like, some of those Kobe and Shaq teams were playing with, like, Glenn Rice, Derek Fisher. I mean, it was sort of touch and go with some of the role players they had. Whereas Klay and Draymond are elite in their own right. And so, I don't know. I mean, second half tonight, I was like, maybe they win three more. And that also changes the KD conversation a little bit, right? Because if, like, there are going to be a lot of people who second guess how much this title should count for Durant. And, you know, we'll have plenty of time to debate that. But if he wins three or four more, that puts this team on a whole different historical level where, they're kind of the Bulls of this generation.
Yeah, I was trying to make that point a week or two ago, which is, like, the more that Kevin Durant wins, the less people are going to hold the decision against him, right?
Yeah.
If he comes away with four titles and two finals MVPs, which I'm not saying that's conservative, but that's certainly in play, I don't think he's getting that much backlash when he retires. And I think people would say he retires as the second best small forward of all time at that point. I think it'd be LeBron 1, KD 2.
So I wonder, though, whether, I mean, I was young during the Jordan years. I mean, I was probably 10 or 11 years old when he won that last title. And I wonder if it felt like as much of a foregone conclusion as some of these Warriors titles. Because when we look at like all-time legacy and the way sort of great players become legends, you need a credible foil to almost push you to a higher plane. And I wonder who that could be for the Warriors, because it's not like LeBron is in like GOAT mode right now and he's not really getting it done. So who could it be?
Well, you're the draft expert, clearly.
Yeah, whoever takes De'Aaron Fox is going to be in great shape.
Yeah, clearly it's going to be Kyle Markkanen. No, I have a story for you, though, because you were mentioning, was it a foregone conclusion with Jordan? And when I was 10 years old, or I guess 9 years old, during the 1993 finals, the Bulls were up 2-0, and they drop a very dramatic Game 3 against the Suns. And I locked myself in the closet and refused to come out. And I was, you know, basically near tears. And, you know, my dad's like, what are you doing in there? Come out. I was like, no, like, the Bulls are going to lose. Like, Michael's going to lose. It can't go this way. And my dad was like, don't worry. They are definitely not going to lose. And I was like, but why? And my dad was like, well, they've got Mike. You know, and that was just like, that was the entire conversation.
That's all you need to know.
Nothing more needed to be said. And I think that was pretty much the feeling throughout the 90s, you know, with all of his championships, is that, you know, even when he was getting older, you know, even when they were on the road in some tough environments like Utah, it was pretty much, you know, they were invincible. And I think the aura of invincibility started pretty early with him.
Yeah, you're right. Well, and also in retrospect, I mean, I remember as a kid looking at those Jazz series and sensing drama, but in retrospect, it's ridiculous that anyone ever thought that a big three of Karl Malone, Stockton, and Hornacek was going to beat MJ and Scotty and Rodman, all three of whom are like legit high tier Hall of Famers. I mean, it's kind of like wondering whether the Clippers could beat the MJ Bulls. So,
well, let's leave Stockton out of this, but I take your point.
Yes. Yeah, my point is that MJ's finals competition was never really that great. And last question, though. So did you say your closet tantrum, that was during the Sun series?
Correct, 93.
That's amazing. My first memory of watching NBA basketball was fighting with my dad to stay up and watch MJ versus the Suns. That was the series that John Paxson hit that shot, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, look, we were destined to host this podcast, just like our KD articles in college. This is perfect.
Well, can I have one postscript on this whole story about, you know, my dad's ability to determine the future? The next game after the closet tantrum, you want to guess what Jordan's line was?
What was it?
55 points, 8 rebounds, 4 assists.
God. See, yeah. Those are the games that don't get brought up often enough when we have the Jordan-LeBron debates. Like, Jordan did diabolical things to teams in the NBA Finals and all over the league. So, we really need to just take out individual games the next time we have these arguments on the internet.
Like I said, when you go back and look at his box scores and like his comps, it's just always something ridiculous. But I guess bringing this back to this series,
what's your parting shot?
Well, I said I thought that they
supporters with Ben and Sharp.
They've got a chance here in Game 3, right? I mean, but do you think it's a sweep? Like, are you ready to go as far as to say you think it's going to be a sweep?
I hope it's a sweep. I bet that it will be a no. I'll say it's a sweep. Yeah.
All right. I'll say they get one. Because just because I've said that the whole way, each passing game makes me less and less confident of that, though.
Well, yes, that is how series work when one team is winning all of them.
No, but it's also the nature, not just the result. And there was one final comment from LeBron that had me a little bit nervous. They asked him about the adjustments for Game 3, and he said, "That's a Ty Lue question. I don't make the game plan."
Yeah, I didn't buy that from LeBron. I think he probably has more input than any player in the league in terms of the game plan. And also, we should highlight, I don't have the energy to go back and find Richard Jefferson's comments before game two, but he sounded like someone who should be committed to an insane asylum. Just as far as doubling down on playing fast and how the Cavs had nothing to worry about, I'm not... Like, you shouldn't say that you're defeated going in, but you also should not have been as confident as Richard Jefferson was coming into game two.
Yeah, I think there might actually be a little tension over this whole pace thing, though. Just the way that LeBron's kind of, you know, deflecting those questions toward the coaching staff in terms of strategy. Having that blow up in their face so badly, two games in a row, and then apparently just deciding that that's going to be how they go down no matter what. When you watched LeBron take better control over the finals, you know, a couple of years ago, even when his teammates were all injured, playing at a more methodical pace, it does make you wonder, like, why don't they at least try it or think about it? But maybe it's just a personnel thing. I mean, maybe they don't feel like they have enough size defensively to get stops in the half court, and maybe it's just trying to play chaos ball. I don't know.
Yeah, I honestly don't care. The Warriors are winning the title, so... We're good. Anyways, have a safe flight to Cleveland, and we will check in late in the week. And yeah, that's it.
Sounds good, Andrew. Take care, man. 5-star reviews on iTunes, openfloormail@gmail.com. Send us your questions for the next podcast. We'll be up later this week.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.